Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead. He was the founder and leader of ISIS, the most ruthless and violent terror organization anywhere in the world. He died like a dog. He died like a coward. The world is now a much safer place.
That was President Donald Trump on Sunday morning announcing the demise of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi after a U.S. raid in the Turkish-controlled section of northern Syria. Hello, everyone. This is Matt Welch, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. We've got some super-duper exciting changes to Reason's podcast lineup that we will hopefully be announcing later this week, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let us say hello to the Reason Roundtable regulars, my treasured colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and a just back from vacation and has no idea what's happening in the world, Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, everyone.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
So to perhaps over-contextualize our conversation here about this, the year 2013 was, I think, in retrospect, a high watermark for what we, some of us, were calling the libertarian moment, or even libertarian Christmas was a phrase. You had the sequester freeze on federal spending, you had, which we'll hopefully get to later. Edward Snowden revelations about a warrantless surveillance by the National Security Administration. Justin Amash came super close to actually defunding the NSA. We were legalizing weed right and left. Rand Paul was having filibusters and getting strange new respect. And there was a grassroots kind of revolt that helped stop President Obama from bombing Syria. If you look back, and we've had conversations like this among us and outside of like, when did that stop? What was the thing that made that stop? There's a really good argument, I think, that it was the rise of ISIS in 2014, and specifically the horrific videotaped beheadings of two U.S. citizens. That was all the devilry of al-Baghdadi. There was a new caliphate. It took up a third of Iraq and half of Syria at its high watermark. And he was the caliph at that time in 2014. After long declines, there was a sudden uptick of interest, U.S. public opinion support for intervention in the Middle East. You had, instead of like the 2010 wave of Mike Lees and intervention skeptics, the new GOP class was all the Tom Cottons and the Hawks and such. And Rand Paul in particular, who had been an early front runner for the 2016 presidential nomination, suddenly seemed to be kind of caught in the vise of all of this. Donald Trump, even though he was running on a campaign of criticizing pretty heavily all the regime change wars, nonetheless was promising to destroy ISIS in his campaign. And let's let that transition us into our first question. And sorry for the long windup. Peter Suderman, as the resident, probably biggest skeptic of the erraticness of President Trump's foreign policy, people back in 2015 and 16 were mocking him for saying that, you know, believe me, that he's going to destroy ISIS. And yet kind of here we are. Does he not deserve credit for the near erasure of the caliphate and the demise of al-Baghdadi?
Well, he certainly deserves credit to the extent that we want to give credit for doing, for killing al-Baghdadi. I mean, it happened under his watch. He appears to have been the person who at least gave the go-ahead or allowed our military leaders to go ahead with the operation. And al-Baghdadi, to be clear, it's hard to imagine someone who more qualifies for the term human scum than him. I mean, he makes pieces of shit human beings look really wonderful. And so I think the world is a better place with him dead. But it's also not clear how much a victory this is in terms of actually making a difference in the Middle East. Spencer Ackerman of the Daily Beast wrote a pretty good piece in the aftermath of al-Baghdadi's killing, basically making the point that Trump's speech, you know, whether you like it or hate it, actually is pretty similar to the speeches that George W. Bush and Barack Obama both gave after killing bin Laden and other foreign terrorist leaders in the Middle East. And in both cases, There were terrorist movements that arose in the aftermath of the killing of the leaders, and that we should expect that to happen again. This is not a sort of this is not the end game. This is not like, it's not like in a movie where you sort of kill a bunch of the henchmen and then work your way up like the value chain until you finally kill the big boss and the movie's
terrorists
over
are
and
not,
it's over.
Terrorists don't operate on vampire rules,
right,
is what you're saying. Like, if we kill the sire, it doesn't eliminate all of ISIS.
And so, you know, like I said, I'm glad this guy is not alive. I'm glad he is out of the world. And if you want to give President Trump some credit for that, I think go ahead. But it's harder to give Trump credit for making here a meaningful impact, at least so far, on the kind of larger global state of affairs.
Catherine, building on that kind of well-actuallying by Peter, it's a thing that libertarians in particular love to do in the wake, particularly of like bipartisan fist pumping over killing bad guys in faraway places. What are your well-actually caveats, if any, of this thing that happened while you were back? So you have no excuse for not knowing that it happened.
It's true. I have no excuse. So I think there were a couple things. In that clip that we played at the top of the show, there was a marked contrast between the very formal, sober tone of the first bit, where Trump announces al-Baghdadi's death, very carefully pronouncing his name, which I absolutely feel total sympathy with the president on. That would be my nightmare as a world leader, would just be like screwing up foreign names. But, you know, he sounds like a smidge presidential there. He's doing the thing, you know, we have killed the biggest bad. And then the second sentence that we aired, which was sort of this like, you know, he died like a dog thing. And for those who didn't listen to the full address, it goes on in that vein for quite some time. There's a very graphic description of, you know, he's in the tunnel and he's got the children and he pulls the vest and he died in a ball of fire. I mean, it's the death of this terrorist leader is told by the president of the United States in an extremely kind of horror movie graphic way. And I think, you know, a thing that struck me is that lots of Americans, I think, had a real direct sense of revenge about the death of bin Laden. It was like, that guy killed our people. He was responsible for all of these deaths on American soil. We got him. And there was a very direct kind of vengeance note to that killing. Here, it's a little more abstract. It's a little more about things that have happened, for the most part, overseas.
Although al-Baghdadi has killed Americans.
True.
Has killed American citizens, like, who were not combatants.
But didn't do 9/11.
That's correct.
I think, you know, let's be
and
clear.
In fact, one of the interesting subtexts of this, you brought up bin Laden, the relationship there, is that bin Laden thought al-Baghdadi had gone too far.
Right.
And that
the need for a caliphate, we
weren't ready for it yet. He was sort of like, you guys, like, the revolution is not supposed to happen here. We just wanted to do some, like, really, big bad terror. But this whole thing where we're going to set up a state, that's too much. It's
like,
really.
Was bin Laden, like, doing a Nokian remnant strategy? Let's not actually get too deep into that comparison.
Wow.
But I think, you know, the attempt to kind of dramatize this killing and to make it an achievement on the scale of the death of bin Laden has some notes of kind of presidential envy to it. It has, you know, some notes of like overselling, possibly because Americans are weary and are no longer really paying attention in the same way that they were to the death of bin Laden. And the Washington Post had a piece today, I think, pointing out that right now, it's not at all clear how people on the ground are going to respond to news of this death. There was some good reporting from inside a prison where ISIS fighters were being held, where they were keeping the news of al-Baghdadi's death from them because they feared a riot. And I think that's a signal of how people expect others in the region and you know, ISIS fighters to react to this, which is not that they're going to be like, oh, well, they got our guy. I guess we're done. Let's all go home. But as Peter said, that there'll be possibly another round of new leadership and new violence.
And I should just add very, very quickly here before we move on to Nick, that Matt, you asked me about Trump's erraticness when it comes to foreign policy. You know, one of the big foreign policy discussion right before this had been Trump rearranging Middle Eastern troops and pulling out of northern Syria and Turkey coming in. And as part of that, some of the prisons that were holding ISIS fighters were destroyed. And the reports are that a lot of ISIS fighters that had been held in some of those prisons have, as part of this maneuver, been let out. And so if we want to sort of see a mechanism for a second wave of ISIS or something that grows out of what ISIS was, that seems to me to be a possibility, a likely contender for seeing this continue, unfortunately, even beyond the death of al-Baghdadi.
Nick, I mentioned Rand Paul at the beginning. I want to invite you and I to move the Periscope back a little bit here. Recall 5 years ago, there was, Rand was sort of caught in the vice, and there's a lot of discussion over his foreign policy views in the wake of these beheadings. On one hand, you had Richard Epstein was saying Rand Paul's fatal pacifism in the face of Syria because he was anti-interventionist there. But then a lot of anti-war types were really mad at Rand because he said that he wanted to destroy ISIS and even get an authorization of the use of military force to make a formal declaration against the caliphate. Does this news kind of maybe sort of justify or put in a better light the way that people were going after Rand 5 years ago? And or, you know, what does this make you think about sort of the cause for what, for lack of better terms, we called on the cover of the magazine in a debate forum we had 5 years ago, libertarian realism?
You know, first thing is this is a good thing that happened. And it's, you know, and if we're talking about the politics of it, it's good for Trump and nothing takes that away. And that, you know, the muted response, well, you know, it's not really going to solve anything, or just like with, you know, killing bin Laden, it's not, you know, it doesn't matter, blah, blah. I mean, that really, to me, it strikes me as like a kind of weakened form of Trump derangement syndrome. Nothing Trump does can ever be good. And to be sure, he steps in it by not, you know, at every moment when he could just say, you know, we got a really bad guy and the world's a better place, he then has to pantomime something which is not supported by any data that or video that the Pentagon has apparently shared with Trump or with, you know, the Department, the Secretary of Defense and whatnot. But it's a good thing, and it's a sign that the terrorists threat, and certainly ISIS, is tremendously weakened over the past few years. It's never going to go away, but it's never going to go away because terrorism is not something you eradicate once and for all, and it will always be recombining. If you wind back far enough, there is a legitimate way of thinking about American intervention in the Middle East, which is not the cause of Middle East terrorism, but helps to explain why al-Qaeda was created and why al-Qaeda bombed the World Trade Center, as opposed to, you know, other targets, which, of course, it also did. Same thing with ISIS and whatnot. Trump's failure here is not one of rhetoric or one of action. It's one of strategy and planning, because he's talking out of both sides of his mouth in terms of getting out of Syria, which we should absolutely do, but we should also be out of Iraq and out of Saudi Arabia, or radically reconfiguring our engagement in that area. So that, as a back, you know, as a setup, Matt, I think the real question about Rand Paul and the libertarian moment and things like that is that what happened is Rand Paul, at a crucial moment, failed to articulate a foreign policy that made sense to anybody, whether it was pacifist, you know, or non-interventionist of a libertarian stripe, or a conventional kind of people still working within a Cold War framework. When ISIS, you know, arose and there were those series of beheadings and, you know, high-profile murders and torture videos from ISIS, he did not rise to the challenge and say, you know what, like, we're not going to, you know, we shouldn't re-up on war because of these killings. This is what we should be doing, and this is how we have to orient ourselves to the world in terms of military engagement, as well as cultural transmission and, you know, trade and diplomacy. I think that's really the big lesson. And, you know, and nothing has changed since then. We have been stumbling towards it. One of the most attractive things about Trump was that, you know, and again, he's erratic, he's not systematic or whatever thing. When he, you know, a stunning moment happened when on a debate stage, he said that George Bush was wrong about the Iraq War, and that the Republican Party and that the military industrial complex was wrong about that. And he was fundamentally right. We're still waiting for him or anybody else in power to really articulate a meaningful alternative to a shitty version of Cold War hegemony, which is what the U.S. has been pursuing one form or another since at least 1945.
I guess what I'm not seeing, Nick, is any real daylight between what Rand was talking about in 2014 and what Trump did, right? Mm-hmm. Rand said we need to destroy ISIS. Trump said, I'm going to destroy ISIS. And he more or less destroyed the caliphate at the least, and did so while also saying, Trump did, that we shouldn't, on balance, intervene into Syria, which is something that Rand Paul said too. So like you're giving Trump credit, but also saying that Rand failed in the moment.
No, because Rand Paul did not, you know, he without kind of acknowledging a broader vision of what foreign policy should be. My recollections of that, and I was what was good is that, you know, he helped stop us from going full bore into Syria, and we need to remember too. By all accounts, you know, the only reason U.S. troops are in Syria was because of an ad-libbed comment about red lines, you know, that that Barack Obama made in a speech. You know, there was no national security interest. There's no reason for us to be in Syria. And, you know, taking it back to that, at a very particular moment, Rand Paul needed to step up and really fill the, fill the auditorium with a vision of a foreign policy that was fundamentally non-interventionist, the one that he had ridden, I think, you know, very high in the polls on. And he didn't do that because he was afraid that he was going to be portrayed as a weakling or, you know, as an isolationist. And that's a problem. Trump doesn't have those same problems. And Matt, you might be right that, you know, operationally, it's the same thing. The problem with that is that if the United States is concerning itself overly much with ISIS, what the hell is that? ISIS is not a threat to American national interests. They killed a bunch of Americans who shouldn't have been in that region either as private citizens or contractors or as military. But that's a different question than saying, you know, we have to stamp out every regionally based terrorist group that has beef with, you know, all of its overlords in a particular area.
Catherine, let's build on that a little bit. Nick says, you know, ISIS is not necessarily a threat to American interests. But is there, there's a couple of different concepts here. One is like, what do you do with a stateless terrorist organization and or overlapping terrorist organizations, which is sort of the post 9/11 challenge. But then there's terrorist organizations that go ahead and get a state. They carve out a state in the middle of stuff. They're trying to commit acts of war or terrorism against the U.S. or against other people, and they've gone ahead and created a country. Is that not cause, even in a libertarian world that leans heavily towards anti-war, isn't that like a knock my block off situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously I was away last week, but this is an interesting contrast with our discussion of the Kurds and what we owe to the Kurds from 2 weeks ago. They also kind of went ahead and created a state for their own purposes, not for the purposes of eventually spreading a death-loving, misogynist, totalitarian regime across the Islamic world and perhaps the entire world, but just because kind of they wanted a place to live where people would stop killing them, I think, though that, of course, oversimplifies both of these circumstances. But yeah, I think, you know, I do think since 9, like, not to be all Rudy Giuliani about it, but like 9/11 did change everything. Since 9/11, all of the actions of terror organizations in this branch of the family tree have been the business of the United States and just are going to be. And even everyone except the most extreme anti-interventionists and isolationists typically do a to be sure about them, right? Like they typically have done, as Rand Paul did, as Donald Trump has done, well, of course, we have to stop these bloodthirsty terrorists. But then after that, maybe we won't do the nation building or whatever. And it's just not so simple to separate those two ideas. I wish there was a bright line somewhere, but there isn't. And that is a huge challenge for libertarian realism or anything like it. Anything that you want to, where you want to choose a line of engagement that has to do with U.S. interests properly understood or defense of our homeland or some other similarly terrifying Orwellian phrase, you know, I don't know where the next leader of the next thing that will be like ISIS will fit in that paradigm, but it's not a question I can easily answer.
Peter, as these things always do, the Trump press conference or whatever it was on Sunday, and even the tweet he did the night before saying something big just happened, stay tuned, and then spilling out all the way into yesterday's World Series game, which I know that you were riveted by, Peter, at which President Trump showed up in person and was very roundly booed. Since then, it's been a lot of discussion about the manners and etiquette of policy, whether it's Trump's etiquette or lack thereof in his own press conference, including like taking credit for knowing who Osama bin Laden was in 2000, or the etiquette of booing a president after he has this big victory. You are both the process guy, but also I'd like you sort of implicitly to respond to Nick's Trump derangement syndrome comment. Are people kind of losing their marbles and having abstracted conversations instead of like talking about the policy of all this stuff?
It sounds like that's what we're doing right now, maybe. No, I mean, it's hard to really figure out which I care about less, baseball or President Trump getting booed at a baseball game. Like, I just can't imagine like having a strong opinion or getting worked up or having feelings really one way or another about either of those things. What matters is what Trump did. And to a lesser extent, it does matter how he presented what he did to the country. A big part of the president's job is to explain what the government does, to explain what the executive branch does, and in particular to sort of deliver the message, here is what your tax dollars are funding in terms of the military. And so I think it's a little bit more legitimate to kind of call into question or at least raise questions about whether Trump's tone in announcing the strike and the killing of this guy was appropriate, as Catherine did. But even still, the question, like, they're at least secondary questions. The primary question is, what's important about what Trump does? What's important about, you know, about what the government, what the executive branch is doing, about what Congress is doing, about what Trump has done and how Congress is going to treat that with regards to impeachment? All this kind of stuff about whether, you know, Trump is presidential or not, I think is secondary at best. And a lot of it, especially when it intersects with baseball, is completely meaningless and unimportant.
Let's use that as an opportunity to transition to the impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives. There was so much damn news about just that over the past week. It's kind of hard to know where to begin. A quick summary. You had a pretty damning and almost immediately leaked testimony, or at least opening statement, by former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Bill Taylor, which made a case that the president and Rudy Giuliani were operating a kind of rogue foreign policy shop that aimed to hold up U.S. aid in exchange for a public announcement by the Ukrainian government or president that he was investigating the family of Joe Biden. You had Rand Paul, who we're going to talk about a lot, apparently forever, making a very vociferous case that such conditioning of aid is business as usual in American foreign policy. There was a secrecy with leaks kind of approach by the House Intelligence Committee, came under a very sharp attack from Republicans. A group of them stormed the secure facility. The world all pretended to know what SCIF stands for a hot minute there. So maybe
people in Washington, as someone who lives in Washington, people in Washington know what a SCIF is, Matt Welch.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Catherine knows what a SCIF is. That's what you sail on in, on the outskirts of Harvard.
Wow. We turned that into a Catherine has a yacht joke? Yep. I did know what a SCIF was before.
Sensitive compartmented information facility. I always want to say compartmentalized, but everybody knows
like
what a SCIF is.
A psychological problem.
You know, like kids, you know, more kids are named SCIF, born and named SCIF than any other name in the DC area, Matt. Come on. You know that.
That's a really good name. That's a tease to my.
It sounds like the fifth
my kids,
generation.
Skiff and Daenerys.
No, yeah. I know. I think it's like Skiff and Trey, like the fourth generation of like someone whose actual name is like Edward Moncure, the 57th or something.
Let's maybe just start by anyone. Well, let's start with Nick. So he's everyone. Mm. to talk about anything that jumped out in particular with where we are at in impeachment inquiry, sort of pre, you know, articles of whatever we're at right
now. I think all of the tidbits that come out, you know, work almost without exception to merely cement both sides in their belief that this is either a righteous mission from God that has to be done at all costs, both to process and to reality, or this is, you know, a demonic intervention that has to be stopped and is further proof that, you know, Trump is right about everything and that it's nothing less than a silent coup or a loudmouth coup to take him out because, you know, the elites can't stand him. Until we actually see the articles of impeachment, none of this stuff matters. And it's really kind of tedious in a lot of ways to have, you know, again and again, you know, you get testimony that gets, you know, that gets leaked or is unrebutted. And then people are like, we've got him. You know, it's a lock type case. Let's take the rest of the week off. And inevitably, it doesn't work that way. And it's not going to. The articles of impeachment will go, you know, assuming they go through, it'll be interesting to see what's actually in them. And if they're going to push the heavy quid pro quo line in Ukraine, it's going to get blurry really quick. And I would direct people to Cheryl Atkinson's piece in The Hill, which came out a few days ago, where it's kind of a quick explainer of how messy foreign policy is. And foreign policy is always conducted in that weird space of both demanding obvious quid pro quos and never actually saying that. And unless something really comes out that is completely, absolutely the case, which is, you know, Trump saying that he wants, you know, the Ukrainian government to absolutely destroy Joe Biden so that he can win the 2020 election, it's not going to be enough to change public opinion. That may not be what's, you know, ultimately going to decide all of this, but that's the court that this is being, you know, kind of litigated in. And it's so, you know, everybody needs to fucking like take a deep breath and recognize that we are barely, you know, we're not even to the title sequence yet in this impeachment saga.
So, for example, Trump asked Ukraine and China to investigate Joe Biden while standing on the White House lawn in front of a whole bunch of news cameras?
Because he's saying, I am asking you to investigate Ukrainian impact and influence in the 2016 election, because we've got to get to the basis of this corruption stuff.
We've got to look at
Biden. Yeah, I know. And it's going to be because Joe Biden did this, that, and the other thing. And it's about the 2016 election. It doesn't have to be accurate, Peter. And, you know, Trump is a master of doublespeak. He is good at gaslighting. But it's like, do you think people who believe in Trump and like, you know, he's had no major reduction, certainly among his supporters in support since any of this came out, it's not going to matter. And there is a legitimate question, like foreign policy is always done in a push and pull type of thing. So I'm just saying, like, if you want Trump to be removed from office via impeachment because he told the Ukrainian president that he's not going to give him some military aid unless he digs up the dirt on Joe Biden and delivers it, That's not going to work to remove Trump at any point soon, unless something really comes out. It's like the P tape. It's like all sorts of stuff, lots of suggestions. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But I'm betting at this point that it's not going to have the effect that it's, you know, Trump opponents want.
Do you think he should be impeached for that? Just like you personally, like
I am.
You
know, this is and let me to bracket this a little bit. I do not think, unlike many people on the Reason staff, I do not think that all presidents should always be impeached, which is a popular opinion among the magazine staff, that we need to be impeaching presidents more often. And I think almost everybody on this podcast has said that or something like it. I don't think that. I think that there are grounds to actually, you know, bring some kind of case against Trump based on what's out there in the public record. Whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing for the Democrats or for the country, I don't think it's going to help the Democrats in 2020, to be quite honest. And I don't really give a shit about who wins the 2020 election based on, you know, this type of stuff. But I think that they have a legitimate case to say, you know, there are high crimes and misdemeanors that are worthy of impeachment. They have to distill that into specific charges, and then they have to work that through the House, and then they have to, you know, get a removal in the Senate. I don't think that's going to happen. And I agree with Gerald Ford talking in 1970 or 70. 1971, that impeachment is ultimately a political act. I think it's bad politics for the Democrats, probably for the country. And, you know, mostly what I'm pissed about is, like, we've got a lot of things that we should be talking about and legislation that should be worked on, which is obviously never going to happen. It's probably wrong to blame impeachment for the reason that's not going to happen, because if it wasn't impeachment, it would be something else that would push off, you know, things like massive deficit spending and a bunch of other really stupid things, including like having a legitimate foreign policy as opposed to, you know, weird heartburn-induced decisions by everybody going back to at least Bill Clinton.
Worth pointing out, Nick referenced public opinion. There has been a difference in the public opinion in reaction to the Ukraine stuff than there was under over the Mueller report. It's a much more people are much more inclined, including Republicans compared to where they were with the Mueller report, inclined to be favorable towards impeachment. So far, take that for what it's worth. Catherine, I'm very curious, how much were people on the Amalfi Coast talking about Trump impeachments and whether the House Intelligence Committee should be engaged in selective leaking from its secure facilities?
Zero. There was zero talk about that. In fact, at one point, my husband attempted to read to me something from the news, and I literally stuck my fingers in my ears and said, la, 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 la.
Those are long fingers, too.
Yeah, it worked. I did not hear whatever news he was trying to tell me. But I have since done some news reading, and my favorite tidbit so far is just like three quarters of the way down in a Washington Post story, which has the great headline, quote, "It feels like a horror movie. Republicans adrift and anxious defending Trump." This to me sounds like absolutely
seasonally appropriate.
Yeah, it is. It feels like this quote right here sounds like everything that I need to know from what happened while I was away. Quote, "There's frustration. It feels to everyone like they're just digging a hole and making it worse. It never ends. It's a total bracket expletive show," said one Republican strategist who had been advising a number of top senators and who, like several others interviewed, spoke on a condition of anonymity to be candid. Like, that's what happened while I was away, right? Like, people speaking anonymously who probably are making all the decisions don't know what's going on. And also, even though everything is a nightmare, we're still not going to print the word shit in the Washington Post. The end.
But, the larger narrative, and, you know, that phrase is overused, but, like, you know, that what you just read feeds into that, though. Right. Where it's like, so you have an unnamed source, a top Republican consultant who works with senators,
et cetera. Yeah, exactly.
It's like, so the elites, the deep state is after Trump. You know,
a bunch of elites are saying to a bunch of other elites on the condition of anonymity that maybe things are sort of dumb and bad, but also not so dumb and bad that we're willing to fully come out and say they're dumb and bad, thereby siding with the people who want to, I guess, impeach the president.
I have been to cocktail parties at anonymous Republican strategist houses. And let me tell you, their cocktails are not as good as mine.
Yes.
But you said that on the condition of anonymity in order to be candid.
No, I'm saying that in my own voice right here. Yeah. That's Peter Suderman takes credit. Anonymous Republican strategists have worse cocktails than I do.
I literally did not communicate with anyone about the news at all for the entire week, but I did send Peter like four or five important slacks about a Negroni that I drank. So
the footnote that you need to understand here is that I have arranged my life so that people are constantly texting me menus of cocktail bars from around the world, and it's one of the best things about being me.
Actually, Twitter is good.
Yeah.
I would just add that Catherine said that's an accurate description of last week. I think it's the accurate description of all of the last weeks. Go on, Peter.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that piece that Catherine noted is really useful in that a big part of the point of that piece is that Republicans in the Senate are very uncomfortable with what's happening in the impeachment process because they don't see a substantive defense. They see that House Republicans who are trying to get out in front of defending Donald Trump are attacking the process. They're saying, well, it's secretive, it's behind closed doors, the information is being leaked selectively. I think there's some merit to some of this criticism, although this is basically a grand jury indictment, and this is sort of how they work in a lot of cases. And, you know, if you look at the big sort of stunt where they went into this skiff, you know, sort of raided it, like a quarter of the people who were part of that brigade were actually allowed in and would have been able to get access to that hearing totally legitimately. And so the Republican criticism of this right now is entirely process-based. There is no meaningful Republican defense of what Trump has done, with the exception, I think, of Rand Paul's argument that, well, this is just totally normal for foreign policy, which is just not true. It is just not the case that the president of the United States hires his personal lawyer and directs that personal lawyer to intervene in global affairs, to supersede the normal diplomatic process in order to gain personal political benefit. And that is the charge that's being leveled against President Trump. And every indication just about so far is that that is exactly what President Trump and Rudy Giuliani did. Giuliani was saying it on the record in public that he was in Ukraine to try and get a political investigation going that he thought would benefit his client personally and maybe would benefit the country too. But it was he said this to the New York Times in May. Trump stood on the White House lawn and said, yeah, you know what? I think Ukraine and China should be investigating the Bidens. And he's, you know, tried to sort of tangle this up with the idea of, oh, we're investigating corruption. But he was asked, well, are you investigating corruption in any country in any circumstance that does not involve a potential political rival? And Trump's response was just like, we'll see about that. I'll get you an answer or something. I mean, like, he's obviously not. It's entirely about damaging a political rival. And so what has stuck out to me has been two things. One is that Trump so obviously did what he is being what people are saying he did. And two, that Republicans do not have anything like a substantive defense except for what Rand Paul is saying, which is that this is a normal part of foreign policy. And that's just not true. It's just not the case that this is how foreign policy is normally waged.
So here's my other thing, though. Even if it was true, like, let's say it was true. Let's say Rand Paul is totally right. And even if he's not right on this, like, narrow way that Peter has described it, he's right in a more general way that foreign policy is often conducted via quid pro quos and that there are sometimes political overtones, which I think, you know, is kind of true.
Sure. It is true that there are sometimes expectations of other countries, of which are left unsaid, but they're supposed to be in the national interest and they're supposed to be conducted through normal diplomatic channels, not run by the president's personal lawyer who's not appointed.
But here's my deal.
Not part of the State Department.
This is why I'm team impeach everyone, because, OK, let's say that is how it's done. Like, let's say that even if you follow all of the forms and do all the protocols right and there is a quid pro quo, but you believe it's in the national interest. And of course, all presidents do believe that their own reelection is in the national interest. And so I suppose you could split the baby that way or something. But this is team impeach everyone. It's like, if this is normal business is bad and corrupt and we need to blow it up. It's, you know, this is the reverse of my habitual whataboutism, which is, what about if everyone's bad all the time, burn it all down.
Nick, I heard you going in there, but maybe you prefer to leave that on the table.
I was just going to say that, you know, Lindsey Graham, who is, you know, one of the most disturbing figures in American politics. He's emblematic of, you know, of the non-entities who end up becoming very powerful in the Senate. There's only 100 senators, and, you know, most of them are so unexceptional. It's, you know, it's staggering. But he's introduced a resolution, you know, condemning the House impeachment inquiry. 44 Republicans have signed on, 9 haven't. You know, Trump has very strong support. And I think, you know, again, all of this relies on, you know, we're hearing basically one side of the story and the way it is done. And that's assuming that the facts will determine this case or not. But, you know, it's so, you know, I find it, as somebody who wants to detach from process in terms of, you know, so many things about tone policing in D.C. and about, you know, propriety and stuff like that. Just it is just a way to divorce us from actually talking about things that matter. I feel like almost everything that's going on in bed impeachment, it falls into that category right now, because we don't even know what he'll be impeached for. They've got to come up with specific articles. And that's when senators and other people will really start figuring out, am I going to vote with what I think is right, or what I think is right for my party, or, you know, what is right for my career, what is right for the country? It's, you know, at this point, we're just throwing darts.
So I will add, I want to complicate that just a little bit. And I think you are right that if you have to make a bet today on what the outcome of this is, it's that Trump is impeached in the House and not removed in the Senate, and that it's maybe not quite a party line vote, but that most Republicans vote to keep Trump. But I would just say that it's much less certain, I think, that that's what's going to happen than it was even 6 weeks ago. And there are a couple of signs that Republican senators might actually flip and that Trump might actually be removed out of this. And most notably, I would say that the two signs that stick out to me most are Mitch McConnell saying, I'm definitely going to hold a trial, and then doing a very sort of dry presentation to senators saying, look, this is how it might work and this is how it might go. And then, you know, and relatedly, also reportedly telling senators, look, you guys have to figure out what you're going to do in your districts politically. I'm not going to try and run a campaign on this centrally. Mitch McConnell is somebody who likes to defend Republicans and Republican seats, and he is not what he is doing is keeping his options open. He is signaling to us that he is not going to reflexively side with President Trump, at least not yet, and defend him.
At least not publicly.
At least not yet. And the other thing that he did that I thought was, it was very small, but it was somewhat notable because he didn't have to do it, was Trump said something like, well, I talked about the Ukraine phone call. I've talked about all of this with Mitch McConnell. It was a beautiful call, the most wonderful, perfect call ever. Mitch McConnell agreed. And of course, reporters asked Mitch McConnell about this, and McConnell was like, well, I have no recollection of that call, and then made a face like a turtle. And that is a way of saying, I'm not automatically going to be coming to Trump's defense and on his side here. I'm keeping my options open. And when Mitch McConnell is keeping his options open, that means that there is a live possibility that enough Republicans might join with Democrats in the Senate to actually remove President Trump.
How bummed are we that our main mode of political discourse right now is close readings of Mitch McConnell quotes?
Ouch!
It's really not helping. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I mean, if we can, like, our interest, I suspect that our interest in the impeachment stuff, it's not whether or not Donald Trump is impeached and removed from office or not, as much as how do we use this to actually push an argument for limited government in all aspects of our daily lives. And I don't know that worrying about whether or not Mitch McConnell is saying this or saying that gets us very close to that.
I agree with that, but I would say your complaint, which is I feel a lot of, like, I agree with it in many ways. Your complaint is that we're not talking about the issues that matter. And what I always say, and what I will say again, is that one of the biggest reasons, not the only one, but one of the biggest reasons we are not talking about the issues that matter is Trump, is that Donald Trump being in the White House.
Donald Trump does not. No,
brains.
He doesn't scramble. If he's scrambling your brain, you're letting your brain be scrambled. Okay, I understand why he scrambles Republicans and Democrats. He doesn't have to scramble everything else.
Possible that I'm cracking like an egg every morning, but he is scrambling the brains of so many people. I think it's just very clear that he drives people crazy in a somewhat unique way. And while I don't know that removing him or getting past him will get us to the discussions we need to have, I think it is at least a necessary step. And again, that's not to say that I support or impeachment or think that it is warranted in this case, but it's going to be very hard to have better political and policy discussions while Donald Trump remains in the White House, and getting past him might be a step, not all the steps, but a step that helps change that.
And this is the thing that we've been talking about on this podcast and at Reason since the beginning of Trump's candidacy, which is that he's post-ideological, right? Like, we cannot have principled discussions about the correct policy proposals if there is nothing to fit them into. And right now, there is nothing to fit our ideology into. There is no socket to plug our thing into. Sorry, Matt.
But if you get one of those like 240-volt adapters that you have to bring with.
This is, I think, why the metaphor is coming to my mind, because those adapters are kind of shitty. They don't quite work. And meanwhile, Democrats are doing a big ideological thing on their side.
So are Republicans.
It's the opposite of our thing.
I mean, Republicans or conservatives are pushing. They're pushing national conservatism. They're pushing new forms of...
But that's like five fringe...
Yeah, no.
I really think that's like five fringe Republicans, whereas all of the Democratic candidates for their presidency are...
Nothing is holding us back from pursuing, you know, and articulating a libertarian vision. It doesn't have to go through Rand Paul's office.
We're doing that thing, but that's of course true. And we are doing that thing. But at the same time, there is... It feels to me like because of this thing that Peter is describing, because of the post-ideological brain scramble that is happening on both the left and the right due to Trump, it is harder than usual to get purchase with the consistent vision of a free society that we have long peddled. And I think that's genuinely true.
Let the record show that for the past 10 minutes, while you sons of bitches have been complaining that we can't have conversations, I've been trying to shift this conversation towards the deficit, damn you people, to hell.
This is a big metaphor. It's all a big metaphor.
Last week on Friday, the Treasury Department announced that the official federal deficit for fiscal 2019, which ended in September, as they tend to do those fiscal years, was $984 billion. Dollars, which means that in his 3 years in office, Trump has added more has been added to the over national debt under his watch than President George W. Bush did in his entire two terms. Although I don't know if that has been adjusted for inflation. Peter Suderman, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the data showed that President Trump's economic agenda is working. Talking very specifically, Peter, as the resident actuary here, there's going to come a moment when we no longer have economic expansion. It's going to be very difficult in that moment to pay the old age entitlement bills that are due to a lot of people. What happens in lieu of there being enough money to pay out for the various things?
So I think the end of economic expansion is not something that we can necessarily say is coming. It's gonna come. A temporary pause in economic expansion is gonna come at some point. But hopefully, the end of economic expansion does not appear in any of our lifetimes or our children's lifetimes or really ever at all. But guess what? Even if it doesn't come, even if we are in a permanent expansion for the first time in human history, and all of us see only 4% growth or 3 or 4% growth for the rest of our lives, which is not what's going to happen, the Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund is still going to run out. Now, it might not run out in 2026, which is when it's currently projected. It might run out in 2028 or 2030. And then what happens? What happens is they're going to be running on a cash flow basis. So it doesn't mean that they have zero money. What it means is they have not enough money. It is insolvent. And right now it's scheduled to be insolvent starting in 2026, which means it's only going to be able to pay about 90% of its bills. And then that number is going to dip down to about 70% in the decades after that. And when that happens, that's like not very long from now. I just want to, you know, sort of dwell on like the timeline here. When that happens, there is going to be a reckoning because we have tens of millions of seniors who rely on Medicare to get their health care. And we have all of these hospitals and doctors and jobs, a huge percentage of the economy bound up in healthcare. And a big part of that, Medicare, but government spending accounts for half or a little more of all healthcare spending in the United States. And that's today, even before we get a public option or single payer or whatever the hell Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders come up with in the next 6 or 8 years. And so when that happens, politics is going to have to revert to talking about it. There's not going to be an option to just continue on because people are going to be owed things and there's not going to be money to pay them. And somebody's going to have to decide, well, what are we going to do about that? Because people's pocketbooks and health coverage are going to be affected. And it just remains kind of shocking, like sort of understandable in some ways, but kind of shocking how little attention this has been getting from either party in the 2020 race. It is totally conceivable that if a Democrat wins the presidency here in 2020, that the person who is campaigning for the Democratic nomination right now will oversee the insolvency of Medicare's hospital insurance trust fund in 2026, that person will be the person who ends up having to deal with that. And yet none of them are really talking about this at all. The closest that anybody has gotten is this Elizabeth Warren plan to both expand Social Security and boost its benefits while also sort of possibly nominally extending the lifespan of the Social Security trust fund, which is, of course, an accounting gimmick anyway.
Nick, even beyond entitlement promises mm-hmm. and those things that are going to come due pretty quickly, indebtedness itself can be a drag on the economy, which is something that you've written about a lot. Can you touch on some lowlights of that concept?
Well, this is something that left-wing economists at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, as well as most kind of centrist market-based economists agree that, you know, when you reach a certain level of debt in the economy, it slows economic growth down by about a percentage point a year, and it helps explain why annual economic growth is closer to 2% than 3%, you know, over the past 15 years. And there's no reason to believe any of that will change. Large and growing amounts of unchecked debt kind of hurt the animal spirits of the market. People don't participate in the same way because they know somewhere down the line either taxes are going to go up, services are going to decrease, or inflation is going to return and eat away at stuff. So it kind of freezes people out. That's the basic theory. I think what Peter is talking about is it's both depressing and it's not surprising that politicians don't want to talk about having to really grapple with the major inheritance of the post-war, kind of post-New Deal era, which are old age entitlements. And I can tell you this as somebody who started writing about federal budgets, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, a lot. There was, in the early 2000s, you could talk about the federal budget being split between mandatory and discretionary spending. It's now 60-30, where it's all being shifted into mandatory spending and discretionary spending. It's 60-30. And, in order to really deal with where the money is and why it keeps going up, you have to say baldly and correctly and actuarially that Medicare and Social Security in their current forms are not sustainable. And then, once you even say that, people lose their shit. Seniors probably more than others. And then you got to start talking about what comes next. And nobody wants to talk about what comes next. The Republicans, demagogued Obamacare on the grounds that it would destroy Medicare. It would steal from Medicare, which would be a good thing because Medicare is a terrible program. Democrats currently are saying, we want to expand Medicare. We want it to be for everyone or for everyone who wants it, et cetera. This is not a discussion that's going to help us.
The other thing to just add to that is that interest on the debt is becoming a major spending category for the federal government. And so if you look at what we're spending our money on, it's actually this kind of basic discretionary spending that is what we always talk about in terms of what's getting cut is actually going to end up being a pretty small portion of the federal budget. And certainly as a percentage of GDP, I believe it's actually declining.
Yes.
What's increasing is spending on healthcare, is spending on Social Security, and then spending on interest payments. And so as debt increases, the cost of carrying that debt becomes its own kind of category of spending that eats up that is set to eat up in 2029. It's going to be about 2.6% of GDP. And so we're going to be spending a significant chunk of the economy just paying to have all the debt that we shouldn't have.
Catherine, I can't help but notice that the new book release lists are including an ever-growing number of conservative or Republican tracts against socialism. Are you finding that to be convincing in the backdrop of this?
I thought you were going to say the new book release lists are containing an ever-growing number of conservative books about nationalism and what a great idea it is, which those are two sides of the same terrifying coin, which we borrowed from the Chinese.
Thank you for your input. Let's switch to...
it's all bad. Everything is bad. We don't have any money. We don't have any plan to stop spending the money we don't have. And both ideologies have corrupted to their most extreme and least useful forms.
And the nationalism discussion is also weirdly maybe not weirdly, but is also notably untethered from budgetary reality.
Yep, yeah, that's correct.
And there's this whole thing that's like Democrat, part of the kind of nationalist ethos on the right is, oh, well, Democrats gave up on caring about the budget. That should be like, that's worked out pretty well for them. We should do that too, and instead, let's just spend it on our priorities.
Yes, the they started it attitude to not caring about the money we don't have is truly one of the least good developments in a decade of bad development.
And Democrats, of course, are also saying, well, look, Republicans didn't offset the deficit increase from their tax cuts, from spending on the Iraq war, from Medicare Part D. Republicans started it. And so there's really a kind of Hatfields and McCoys of deficit politics going on here, in which we're all, you know, in like one of these generational wars that like never ends. And we're going to end up, I don't know.
That didn't work at all.
That metaphor.
I appreciate that you did that, which I assume was cover for how bad my Chinese borrowed coin metaphor was. So thanks, Peter.
I just ended that on the advice of Catherine Mangu Ward's face.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. My eyebrows were like, stop.
It's not a good sign that at a point where we need to be more serious about kind of basic fiscal rectitude and whatnot, new polls are showing that larger and larger numbers of young voters are willing to vote for self-styled socialists or socialism and things like that. And the rise of modern monetary theory, which is a return of a kind of disabused notion that we only owe government debt to ourselves so we can borrow and borrow with impunity. These are like really the new fronts, I think, on which a kind of libertarian understanding of the world has to really start engaging, because in a broad way, libertarians have won on the kind of cultural side, the idea of lifestyle liberation, of individual autonomy and things. And there's a lot of both Republican or conservatives and liberals who are against that kind of stuff, but we've won that. That's not changing. You are allowed to design your own life however you want to see fit. I don't see that under attack. But the kind of analog to that is like, how do you pay for a government that provides basic services without either that ending up taking over everything or becoming so incompetent and ineffective that it gives rise to a politics of massive redistribution? That's we need to be winning hearts and minds on that you can't pay for everything. Everything can't be a fucking universal benefit, especially in a time of shrinking or flatlining economic growth.
Let's go to our universal basic consumption of cultural products at the end of our podcast here on the Reason Roundtable. Catherine, I want to know what you were, what flavors of lemon you were consuming on the Amalfi Coast.
I did consume a lot of flavors of lemon, but I actually want to do a recommendation that is an oldie but a goodie, because I was listening to an episode of the Hardcore History podcast while I was traveling. And this is like, if you are a fan of podcasts that contain facts, I guess you probably already know about this podcast.
Then why are you listening to this one?
But in case you don't know about Hardcore History, let me give you this gift. It is narrated by a gentleman named Dan Carlin. The episodes are often 5 or 6 hours long. They are ridiculous.
Nope.
What?
I'm going to 5 or 6 hours of podcast.
Oh, I thought you were challenging my claim that they were that long. And I was like, no, they definitely are. The one that I listened to while tweedling around Rome was called The Celtic Holocaust. Mm. And it was about that. It was about Caesar versus the Celts, Caesar and Gaul. And just super awesome. It is also exactly what it sounds like. It is this sort of hilariously kind of metal sounding dude just telling you a bunch of history. But in this, like, the introductions are like, what if you had to give up everything in exchange for everything? Like, they always have like a real, like, super dramatic framing. And then you learn a bunch of stuff about history. They're genuinely great. I had 5 hours of this voice coming around with me as I looked at lots of ruins. And it was a reminder that this is one of the greatest podcasts out there, and you should absolutely listen to it. The end.
Speaking of movie trailers, because that was movie trailer voice.
He does. He has movie trailer voice. Yeah, that's
Catherine
correct.
Catherine was using my entry in this is a convoluted shout out to a listener who, if you recall from last week, I was bitching and moaning about the horrors that are being produced by our family movie night here in the Welch compound in Brooklyn. And sweet guy sends this really nice list of like 50 movies you should see before you turn 14. List there. It's BFM. You can find it. Just quick Google search for it, and maybe I'll retweet it out. I put it on my Twitter feed. But anyways, I use that as an excuse to do, obviously, some sort of like a charting math project, which Catherine will be super surprised by, which I sat down with my two daughters and said, okay, here, let's go through the list and we will see whether they are available on our various streaming devices, how much they cost. We will look up Common Sense Media, and this is a shout out to the censors out there, because Common Sense Media is started by a kind of a nightmare person named James Steyer, brother of Tom Steyer, and also the progenitor of Chelsea Clinton's intellectual career. I know I'm giving you a lot of information out there, people, but Common Sense Media as a lobbying,
this is one of those podcasts with facts.
As a lobbying organization is borderline evil. They're always like trying to get Congress to pass terrible things about Facebook and that kind of stuff. But as a website to say, hey, this is an age that we recommend that kids be when they watch X film. And this is what the parents say. And this is what the kids say. It's awesome. So we're sitting there looking at trailers when they were available, seeing what the Common Sense Media age score was so we can determine for a four-year-old. This is a long way of saying that watching movie trailers is hilarious, because boy, were they terrible forever. Like, you want movie trailer voice guy to come in. Bring me movie trailer voice guy. I actually watched the trailer for Back to the Future, which is on this list. And you would think, my God, this is like Steven Spielberg, Robert Zemeckis. We're going to get movie trailer voice guy here. No, it is like this terrible, long stunt with a lot of beep boop computer machines. And then the big reveal is that Michael J. Fox takes his sunglasses off. It is so awful. So the advent of actually snappy and super cliched movie trailers has been a boon for Western civilization. And hopefully next week I'll tell you about how terrible some of these movies are, specifically an atrocity whose trailer I watched called Kes by Ken Loach. Nick, I'm sure you were raised on Kes.
So oh, I thought.
Wait. Can I just jump in real quick, though, and say strong endorsement of this theory, Matt. I watched the Princess Bride trailer recently. Horrible. A nightmare. It was like, don't watch this movie, whatever you do. Also wanted to say the other thing I listened to last week was this podcast. Like, I listened to you guys with Stephanie Slade doing this podcast, and I really enjoyed it. I should like not be on the podcast more often so I can listen to the podcast. But I was really disappointed that you could not compare the original Parent Trap to the Lindsay Lohan one. Like, what even are you doing holding yourself up as a Parent Trap commentator without having done the research?
Agreed.
Man.
Fair
Agreed.
Enough. Nick Gillespie, what say you?
Matt, I was going to ask, where does Blame It on Rio show up on that list of 50 movies to see by the time you're 14?
That was
the swan song of the classic jailbait era in Hollywood. Rightly so.
Yeah, also a great Michael Caine.
Featuring, of course, Sir Michael Caine. It's the one movie that's worse than him than he did than Jaws in 3D, I think. I watched Silicon Valley, the premiere episode of the final season of the Mike Judge HBO show about, the tech community and whatnot. And that is, I'm really looking forward to it. Mike Judge, in general, going back to the late 80s, has been, one of the greatest, I think, satirists of American mores between things like Beavis and Butthead, King of the Hill, Office Space, Idiocracy, now Silicon Valley. He's just managed to comment in massively funny and informative and searing ways on everything we are as a society. And Silicon Valley, its final season started, and it is really fascinating to see where it goes, because Judge is, his politics are kind of offbeat, where he's anti-authority and anti-authoritarian, but he's also really anti-bigness. And he busts a lot of seams, I think, that particularly libertarian people want to kind of pretend don't exist. So he's kind of a libertarian populist in a way, if that phrase makes sense. And the show is just fantastic.
Xin Yang is still with us?
Very much so. He's more important than ever. And this is also, and you know, he managed this in King of the Hill as well, which the end of that show, which was on for something like 13 seasons, ended up getting the rollout of the final episodes got screwed up because it was on Fox, the Fox Broadcast Network, and it ended during football season, so things kept getting preempted. But King of the Hill has one of the greatest final seasons in, you know, for a long series, and even after the first episode of Silicon Valley, this is going to come together very nicely, and I'm looking forward to the Silicon Valley fans will know who Russ Hanneman is, but he appears to be appearing in the next episode, which is reason enough to sign up for HBO Go for a lifetime subscription.
Wow. Suderman, take us home.
So one thing I watched was The Current War, and it is a movie about Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse and their kind of rivalry as to set up the first systems, the early systems of electric light in the United States. The movie has gotten pretty trashed in reviews. It's got like a 33 on Rotten Tomatoes. It's not a great movie, but it's better than that. And I just want to sort of briefly offer it to people who are looking for a movie about what technology and corporations can bring to this world, because it's a sort of a rare movie about, like, hey, corporations made our lives better, and in part they did that through competition, which basically worked, and sort of developed something that changed the world, mostly, you know, almost entirely for the positive. But really, I want to talk about the new Kanye West album, Jesus Is King, which is a very long time coming. He's been kind of teasing a big new full length since at least the fall of 2018, and then it was going to be called Yandy at that point, and then it was supposed to come out earlier this year. There was an actual release date, and they missed the release date, and we're like, oh, it's coming in 3 days. I mean, it's sort of like a writer filing a feature. Sorry, Catherine. I promise I won't ever do it again. It is not it's not his best album, but it's really good, and the standouts are incredible. And I will just mention one here, which is that the penultimate track, really the sort of the big closer, Use This Gospel, features guests, a guest verse by Clips, and then a solo by Kenny G. And it's completely unironic, and it is amazing. And so people are talking about this album in terms of it's Christian themes. It's sort of, he has repurposed sort of gospel traditions and music and sort of made an album, that's all about his faith and all of that. And that's all interesting. And I think that's sort of worthy of discussion. But Kanye West is such an incredible sonic innovator. The guy just knows how to combine sounds together in ways that are thrilling and incredibly pleasurable, instantly memorable. Like, it's one of those albums you can sort of, you listen to it, it's 30 minutes long, and you know the songs already, like just one time, just after one time through. And there's a couple of real standout tracks on this. He just remains such an incredibly exciting and thrilling producer of sounds, and of music that sort of sticks with you, regardless of what the actual topic under discussion is. And so if you like music that sounds interesting, like you just have to listen to this. I've probably listened to it a dozen times already.
I definitely don't like music that sounds interesting, but I do like that you have just explained for me one of the great mysteries of social media from earlier this year, which was, I don't know if you saw this photo of Kenny G in the middle of a white room surrounded by 1,000 bud vases containing a single rose each, which was the Valentine's Day gift by Kanye to Kim Kardashian. And now it all makes sense.
I didn't see that, but it does now.
Wow. I think that you should title your new music critic criticism column Music That Is Pleasurable to Listen To by Peter Suderman. It really narrows things down.
I think that's like the Onion come to life right there.
That's all the yee we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable. Thank you for listening. And please stay tuned to the various Reason podcast channel and mentions for exciting news coming up this week. And that's all I will tease you with. We'll see you back here next Monday. Goodbye.